This is Jesus Shalom, a conversation about peace, spirituality, values, and activism from a Jesus-centered, world-embracing, shalom perspective. I'm Tim Peebles. Each episode of Jesus Shalom explores what a Jesus-centered, world-embracing peace looks like in thought and life, conviction and practice. And I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Mari Yorsted, a scholar of the Old Testament, on her book, The Hebrew Bible and Environmental Ethics. In the book, Mari engages the Old Testament through the lens of an animist or indigenous worldview, in which the world is full of persons, only some of whom are human. Earth and trees, rocks and rivers are seen as alive and relational, a view Mari also finds to be pervasive in the Hebrew scriptures and its wider ancient Near East context. The conversation was great, and you should check it out a couple episodes back, but there were a few places where the theologian in me wanted to go a bit deeper, to explore some broader theological questions. And Mari was kind enough to make some time for that broader and deeper exploration. I should say that I understand that this conversation might not be for everyone. If spirituality and practice are more important to you than abstract ideas and thought, no worries, you can jump to the second part of the conversation or skip the whole thing entirely. But if you decide to stay around, you might find the conversation interesting as we talk about whether the Bible sees God as material rather than spiritual, and like other than human persons and not just human beings. In the second half, we also explore whether the idea of a divine covenant with nature allows for nature to fail, an important consideration as we continue to think about and live with a viral pandemic. Please note, we do dive right into the conversation without my usual small talk and background introductions. That said, I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. I just have this, there's two questions I wanted to explore with you. One is, now, there's been a couple scholars, Benjamin Summer, mm-hmm. The Bodies of God, and then most recently, a New Testament scholar just came across her work. Brittany Wilson has a book called The Embodied God, and both of them...
Brittany Wilson was at Duke with me.
Yes, that's right. She's a New Testament at Duke. Yeah, so her new book just...
I don't know her well, but...
Okay. Well, her new book just came out. It's called The Embodied God, and she refers to Summer. Mm-hmm. But in that line of interpretation, there's a recognition that in the ancient world, or at least the ancient Near Eastern world, divinity was seen as a kind of materiality, a different kind of materiality, but material. There was a divine stuff, mm-hmm. A materiality that was fluid and could be embodied in different ways and in different times and place. And that our notion of an immaterial divinity is not really a particularly biblical notion. You might get some glimpses of it in the New Testament as Platonic thought was sort of making its way into later New Testament stuff. I'm wondering if your understanding of animism and an animist kind of perspective sheds any light on this. Is there a resonance between that and some of this conversation?
So I'm going to answer that like kind of roundabout.
Sure. However you want.
Yesterday.
Oh, wonderful.
So we were talking about Leviticus and someone asked about, we were talking about what it means to be unclean and basically how for a person being unclean isn't really a problem. Like it's not bad to be unclean. People right. are unclean all the time, but it is a problem for the sanctuary. And so someone asked, does the sanctuary become unclean by kind of physical touching? Like if someone spits on it or something, or well, spit is not really a problem, but you know, menstrual blood or something gets on the sanctuary. Or is it like immaterial? So like there's like a mystical force that makes the sanctuary unclean. And what I said was that distinction is not a distinction in the Bible. No. So someone putting blood in the wrong way on the sanctuary makes it unclean, but so does lying or swearing false oaths or, and they're not really seen as different. And I think that relates, even if it doesn't seem like it does. So, I think part of what sort of animism provides in terms of divinity is in part that God is like way more relational than, so it goes way beyond like, do you have a personal relationship with your Lord and Savior? right. though, you know, that's a relationship too. But God is way more relational with more things in more bodily ways. And that is often described as sort of God's body being in relationship with other kinds of bodies. But whether or not it's like touchy or not, it's not emphasized, like it's not talked about, I think. Like, so, I mean, you have passages where God is talked about as having hands and faces and, you know, all that is like all over the place. And sacrifices are sometimes described as food offerings for God, though the worshipers eat it. Though God also says, like, I don't need you to feed me in other passages. But I don't think it's almost like the question, like, does God have a body or not, isn't asked. Because the important thing is that God relates with you in your body, and that you relate with God in God's body in some way. That's like more important than like, is God physical stuff or some kind of other stuff? Like the wonder of it is that like God resides with Israel, and whoa, we've got to be careful now. Not like the extent to which the like materiality versus spirituality thing doesn't come into it as much, I think.
Right. Yeah. Even the language of reside suggests a kind of bodily, physical.
Yeah. God kind of is notion. More in some places than in other.
Right.
Right. Like that's part of what it says, which is kind of shocking, but also kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I take away from some of this is that the Western philosophical theological tradition that emerged in the medieval period is fine for its time and place. I mean, it did what it had to do in that particular intellectual environment, but it's a mistake to read that back into the scriptures. I mean, I see theologians doing this all the time of trying to find a timeless, immaterial, omnipresent deity from this or that verse. And I think at least what I want to say is they're just not thinking in these kinds of categories. It's a very foreign conceptual system that we need to spend more time with before we start making these comparisons. Does that seem fair?
Yeah. And as you say, so I am very much a biblical scholar.
Yeah, I understand.
And which is not just like, I think actually the classes that had the most kind of personal influence on me in seminary were actually theology classes.
Interesting.
So it's not, I don't say that to like say that theology isn't also a like very good discipline, but the Bible just isn't systematic, right? It's not trying to set up like systematic dogma in that way. So I think, I guess I struggle with the relationship between the sort of the Bible as it is and how do we get to dogma? Because like, you know, for example, the Jewish tradition emphasizes what's the Latin word? The negative, right? Like all the things we can't say about God, which in some ways is an invitation to say all kinds of things. But we can't make definite statements about God. And I think the way that the Bible does that, it says many, many different things don't easily boil down to like, let's define God's body. Because you are going to find texts that are, you know, like the Bible is very much against having too many representations, which clearly they did have representations, but the temple is in a sense empty. Yeah. Even though you have the Ark of the Covenant, there's no like, here is our statue of God. And so you know, I think you can find support for at least a strong resistance to clearly defining what God God's body is like.
Right.
So I guess, like, I don't think the solution is to say, like, oh, it's the opposite of what people have been saying.
Right.
It's like, sure, both and.
Yeah.
And that's part of why I think the Bible is hard to deal with if you want, like, a set of propositions about God.
Right.
Because you can always find the other thing somewhere.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's like in Job or something, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, when I learned, when I started doing theological studies, I remember one of my teachers saying, there's different ways that theology works. There's the theology just of everyday people thinking and speaking about God. And etymologically speaking, definitionally, that is theology. But then there's a kind of reflection on that speech. There's a kind of mm-hmm. systematizing of that, of trying to sort out what's right and what's not right about it. And that's where we get doctrine and dogma and things like that. And you don't really see much of that second kind of theology in the scriptures. There's maybe some, seems to me anyway, there might be some bits of it in this shift towards a more explicit monotheistic sensibility in ancient Israel. It does seem to me that over the course of the Old Testament, by the time you get to the end, there's these strong statements of monotheism,
right,
that are not our God is the best alongside other gods, but our God is the only,
yeah,
and the others are pretend.
Yeah.
That strikes me as a kind of theology that's a little closer to what we normally do. But again, that sits in the canon alongside all those other things, which are still henotheistic or pluralistic or whatever you want to call it, where our God is one among others and ours is maybe supreme or preferable or whatever, but there's still these other gods.
You like this one better?
Yeah.
Well, and I think the other place that in some ways is a little bit like that may actually be Job, which is it's dialogue and there's no real conclusions.
Yeah.
But it is an intentional engagement with tradition.
Yeah.
An intentional critique of tradition. But still in such a like story form that it's very far from what we would think of as systematic theology. But they're raising many of the sort of important questions of like themes that run through the Bible. But they all disagree and it's not clear who God sides with. So,
right.
Yeah. And people have, you know, people have differed in history, like interpreters of the Bible have differed in terms of who they think kind of wins.
Yeah.
But like now we tend to think like Job's the hero, but that's not always been the consensus.
Yeah. And different accounts of God in that as well, of whether God's being a bully and blustering,
yeah,
or whether God is sort of just asserting sovereignty and putting Job in his place. Very different kinds of readings. Yeah. Well, a similar question along these lines is, you know, in contemporary discourse or thought about God, we often hear the language of a higher power or life force or these kinds of things, which depersonalizes God, at least insofar as we think of persons as like human persons. But if you're thinking about persons in a more animist way, persons as entities that have action and receptivity and engagement and relationship, then it seems conceptually possible anyway to think of God as person like that, but not person like us. A different kind of person, a more impersonal person, less human person and more river person or rock person and so forth. So I'm wondering, as an Old Testament scholar, as a scholar of the Hebrew scriptures, whether you would see any evidence for that kind of notion of God, not as the sort of controlling one. Again, we have to recognize there are just different views of God throughout the Old Testament, but is there one in there where we have God as life force, as as more like a rock person or a river person than rather than the anthropomorphic human person.
So maybe I wrote my dissertation about all the other things because I was too unsure about God or making any definite statements. So the short answer is, I don't know. But I do. So, I mean, I think part of what's helpful about animism is that you can say all these things are persons, but also say they are persons in different ways. And there's a, right, like a rock body and a human body are very different. Right. And we expect different things of those bodies for that reason. Well, as I say, rocks don't talk, but you know, there's Annie Dillard's book, teaching a stone to talk, which is lovely. But so there is sort of, there's space for saying God is a person, like on the spectrum of persons, but quite different. But I guess I don't know exactly what that means. And again, sorry, going back to my class yesterday, someone asked about the story in Exodus where God tries to kill Moses. Shows up in the middle of the night, tries to kill Moses, and Sephora circumcises Moses on the spot and kind of wastes it around and says, "You are my bridegroom of blood." And the students were wondering what this was about. And I was like, yeah, you tell me, I don't know. Great story, but I think in that story, like you do get a sense of someone specific.
Yeah.
Right. It's not the like Platonic idea of divinity.
Sure.
Coming to kill Moses. Like, that makes no sense. And it's not that the story makes tons more sense with a personal God. Like, why didn't God give Moses some warning? but like, I think it's just hard to read the Bible and not read God as a, like as somebody with preferences. And that's hard, right? Because that means, I mean, the hardest bit is that some of us are less preferred than others.
Right.
And some places are less preferred than others.
Yeah.
But it's also very difficult to read it and not see that. So I don't know what to do with that. You know, John Levinson has written about it. Other people have said things. But yeah, I guess if I was going to like stake my claim to something, it would be something fairly vague, like God is a somebody, as opposed to just like a... and in terms of life force, I mean, the enthusiasm for reproduction on every level from plants to, you know, the Bible is enthusiastic about babies.
Yes.
So, you know, that's also maybe a thing that I would point to.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't expecting or anticipating a definitive answer. I was just wondering if you could think along with me on this, and you have. So I appreciate that. These are ongoing. The third part of that is there any notion in the Old Testament of, I mean, contemporary theology talks a lot about participation. The sort of orthodox consensus is that something like participation, that God is uniquely creator and everything participates in God as God's creation. And this is a fundamental departure from whatever started us down the road towards secularism, where we have God as sort of this external cause of things. Is there anything, you have a glimpse of this in the New Testament with Paul's, you know, one claim of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. That sounds very participatory. Is there anything like that in the Hebrew scriptures?
So, sorry, I feel like I'm all over the place, but
that's okay.
I mean, I think one, it's sort of everywhere and nowhere. So like, I think sacrifice is a kind of joint activity for people and God, that they are joint meals, and that the tabernacle and then the temple are kind of a joint hospitality project. So like the people play hosts to God and God hosts the people in the most complicated way, you know, dinner party etiquette pales in comparison. And then I also think the Sabbath So Abraham Heschel describes the Sabbath as the time when God and humans celebrate what they have in common.
Oh, lovely.
That time is common to humans and to God, because time contains eternity. And, you know, there's different rationales given for the Sabbath. So you were slaves in Egypt is one of them.
Yeah.
But the other one is you are to keep the Sabbath because on the seventh day, God rested.
Yeah.
And so we participate in God's rest. It's pretty sort of, it's like you eat together and you rest together.
Yeah.
Like those are the kinds of things. And I mean, and then there's lots of like, you are mine language. So there is an almost like kinship, familial.
Yeah. I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, those sound more like almost a kind of social participation.
Yes.
I think what the tradition is trying to get at is a kind of ontological participation, that God's being is the basis of everything else. And the place that I was thinking along those lines is the play that is possible in Hebrew on Ruach, wind, breath, spirit. And there's a few places where you're not quite sure which is being talked about. I've used personally the idea that my very breath is the breath of God, is God's spirit or God's wind moving through me. That's getting in the direction of a little more of a participatory notion.
Well, in the sort of ruach and nefesh, that God breathes God's wind into the human throat.
Yes.
Which again is, it's also quite, like quite physical.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I think that would make sense.
Well, more to talk about down the road, perhaps, as you've had more adequate time to think about it, or more time with your students to have them stretching you. Questions. Yeah.
All the things I don't know to me.
It's good to be humbled by your students in that regard, isn't it? This podcast is brought to you by Anvil Trust, a charity that articulates, advocates, and advances Jesus Shalom in individual, interpersonal, social, political, and ecological life. To do this, Anvil shapes spiritually and theologically informed faith journeys through interpersonal accompaniment, facilitated conversations, and group presentations. Ways to connect with our Shalom work will be provided at the end of our show and in our show notes. For now, back to our conversation. The other questions I think are probably a little closer to home for your work, so probably less speculative. So part of the animus reading of the Old Testament is, as you've presented it, is that God has a relationship, an independent relationship with the other than human world, a relationship that the biblical writers sometimes refer to as a covenant. Does this suggest that nature, or whatever we want to call the other than human world, is it possible, using that covenantal language, is it possible that nature doesn't hold up its side of the covenant just as humans don't?
Yes.
Can you say more about that? What does that mean?
So there's not a lot of examples of that in the Bible. For the most part, the rest of the world comes off way better than we do.
Fair enough. I mean, we've made a mess of things, so that's only fair.
But Ezekiel is the main example. Where Ezekiel holds very specific parts of the land accountable for failing at things. And it references back to Leviticus, which the sort of most... the clearest obligation in Leviticus of the land is to keep Sabbath. And in Ezekiel, the land is directly prophesied, spoken to, directly spoken to, and given words of judgment and then words of comfort, which has earned Ezekiel a bit of a bad rep in like ecological hermeneutics circles. Seems a little unfair. And it seems like the primary things that you would say that land has done wrong have very much to do with human wrongdoing.
Okay.
But that doesn't negate responsibility in Ezekiel. So, and the same goes for Leviticus, right? Like if people get in the way of the land's Sabbath, then the land has to figure out a workaround.
Yeah.
The land can't just be like, well, I tried.
Okay.
All that to say is like, yes, these, like, as far as biblical writers are concerned, that is very much a possibility. I think part of why you don't see it very often is that for the most part, like the biblical writers seem pretty sort of straightforward about there being a relationship.
Yeah.
But don't claim too much insight into it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, which you suggest sense. A couple of places that we can kind of peek into it or overhear it a little bit, but we don't know specifically about what's going on in it.
Yes.
And from my point of view, just having some biblical indication that God's covenant with nature involves responsibilities on the part of the other than human world that it might not hold up gives us a little bit of a biblical vantage point for talking about things like viruses and cancer. I've seen people just get in knots trying to figure out a way to talk about the goodness of creation, and then our attempts to eliminate viruses. And I've read too much John Levison to go down that line. I think there's resistance in creation to the goodness that God wants for things. And that resistance can be opposed by us, just as we can make it worse. And so something like a virus, there's biblical grounds for thinking, no, we don't have to see anything good about that. We can, you know, there's risk and challenges with how far we take that and so forth, but at least it's in principle possible to say, no, they're just parts of creation that are just not what they should be. And that was there from the beginning. There's always been this element of resistance, tendency towards chaos and destruction that God is always trying to corral, order, shape, and so on.
Well, and I think, again, it's like hard to get systematic about this, but there's both in the Bible the recognition that some of God's creatures do not make for good company for people, right? And that's not because they're bad. It's just like you shouldn't cuddle a crocodile.
Right.
It's not going to end well.
That stands to reason.
And that's not because the crocodile has like gone off script. It's just a crocodile. But then there's also, and the other, besides Ezekiel, the other example is God describing the waters as enemies.
Yeah.
And it's not, I think, necessary to read those as like the waters as imposing deity, or there's no question in the Bible that like that God is like a capable keeper of the waters, but they do pose a threat.
Yeah.
And texts deal differently with what that threat means in terms of its relationship to God. Like, are the waters kind of just like crocodiles? We shouldn't hang out with them too much, or are they actually rebelling? And different texts come down differently on that.
Yeah. Is there any sense, biblically speaking, of nature needing then to be corrected or saved or redeemed?
I don't think not in a totalizing way. So there's, you know, the fall is like very much a Christian lens for reading the Hebrew Bible. And Jewish tradition doesn't depend on that's not an important lens for Jewish tradition in the same way. And so there's not necessarily this sense of like the whole thing has become subject to corruption or whatever. But there's also no question that things got more difficult.
Sure.
There's the sort of garden and things are easier and then things get more difficult. So there's that. And then there's also, there's quite a lot of text that speaks of like comforting the land. So in Isaiah and Jeremiah, and then in Ezekiel, where like the world is hurting in some way and is addressed in very similar language to human people. And it's not, again, it's a little difficult in that like the like being saved or being redeemed are such weighted words.
Yeah.
That it's hard to say like what parts of those come into play, but you know, like God says, I will atone for my land, for example. Hmm. And then in Isaiah, I will comfort the dry places. Like those are words that also are used of human redemption in some way.
Okay.
So I don't know exactly what that means.
Yeah. Like,
again, I'm, I guess, skittish about definite statements, but the same language is used in both cases.
Yeah.
And often it's, you know, it's sort of land experiences of death that are the problem, like drought or extreme logging or things like that.
Yeah.
Trees also get saved from Babylon, which is kind of cool.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, I understand and respect your reticence. I think the questions are coming from what your book does is it calls into question some Western presumptions about how we read metaphor and things related to metaphors with regard to the agency and relationship of the other than and more than human world. And I think if we do that there, then that probably is suggestive for how we think in other places too, along the lines of nature having a covenant with God, not doing what it's supposed to in that covenant, needing to be healed or atoned or whatever words we use there. I mean, we don't need to give a robust philosophical account of what that means. We just need to be able to say, no, this isn't just metaphor. That there is something really happening here, that God's relationship with the other than human world is really a covenantal relationship with mm-hmm. mutual responsibilities and obligations, and God attending to the success and failures of those obligations. We don't know what that means because that's not our relationship.
Well, and also, frankly, we don't know tons about what human redemption means.
Yeah, right? That's right.
It's not like we've got some final answer on that one. Like, I guess what I would be confident in saying is that human redemption is not unique, but that humans are redeemed insofar as God works to redeem the world.
Yeah.
And we don't know quite what that means for us, and we don't really know what it means for other things, but it's equally real for the whole thing.
Yeah, that to me is the sort of logic of the animist engagement, is that there is something real here. It's proper to call that personal, covenantal, and so forth, but we don't have to know what that means for it to be real. And mm-hmm. if we want to just add a little push on top of that, we can say, and we don't really know what it means for us either.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about ourselves being persons, but I mean, there are all sorts of marginal cases, even among the human population, where we have these same questions of, well, what does person mean?
Right. Well, and there's interesting work. I just know this because I heard someone talk about it, but on dementia. And so to what extent is memory necessary for personhood? Because if we insist on memory as being part of personhood, then, or being essential to personhood, then dementia is a loss of personhood.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you relate to someone with dementia, there's definitely someone there.
Yeah,
you
that's know? Right.
So,
yeah. Well, the last question related to this broader question of covenant with the other than human world, that part of the world maybe not doing what it's supposed to and needing atonement and so forth. Is there a role that humans play in that? Say a little bit more of where that's coming from. I mean, where I identify with sort of progressive versions of Christianity where creation care and things like that are very much a prominent part of it. And there's a pushback that comes from folks that are sympathetic to the ecological crisis we're facing, but would say, you know, there's not really much in scripture that says it's our job to take care of creation in the sense of redeeming it, saving it, and all of that. Our job is to live justly. And that will have ramifications on creation. But the idea that we're to somehow save the world is not really a human a calling for us to tend it, to care for it, to live respectfully in relation to it. Yes, but this notion of saving, that's a divine prerogative. It's not ours. So I'm wondering if the language of healing, saving, atoning, any of that cluster of words, whether humans have a role in that for the other than human world, or is that between them and God?
So I don't think there's no relationships in the Hebrew Bible that are completely separate from each other.
Nice. Yeah.
So the idea that something could be just between them and God or between us and God, it's just kind of not possible. So like, for example, the animal sacrifice, right? So like most serious things in the Hebrew Bible require some sort of animal sacrifice, which makes humans dependent on animals for restoring relationship with God, among other things. And there's all kinds of ways in which plants are described as dependent on humans. Like farming is really important in a very fragile ecosystem where water is scarce. Like human planning for drought is a way that humans help other things. It's not described as helping per se, but the sort of lines of need go both ways. And I don't think that humans are described as like the hero of the piece in terms of saving the world, but righteousness on the part of anyone is helpful for the larger righteousness. So like the reins of righteousness, there's reins that help with righteousness. Human righteousness also helps other things. So like keeping the Sabbath is really important for helping the land keep the Sabbath. And in some ways that seems negative to us because we tend to think of the Sabbath as like not doing things,
right?
Which is true, but it's also a huge, like active positive
right.
thing that humans enable Sabbath keeping by other beings by not making them do stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not like it wouldn't make a good movie where like, you know, we come in with like a cape or something, but it's, I also wouldn't, the idea that like humans have nothing to do with the state of the world and its relationship to God, that just seems completely unrealistic.
Yeah,
if sure. I look at that through the Bible, because like everyone affects everyone to an extent that I think make us quite uncomfortable. Like it's great when everyone is doing their best and everyone benefits. It's not so great when people and things get negative consequences because, you know, an Israelite king has done something.
Right.
Then it looks really unfair. But if everything is connected, that's kind of what you get, right? Like everyone experiences things together.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful. What I'm kind of gesturing towards here is, I wrestle a lot with the kind of supersessionist tendencies of Christian thought that look at the church replacing Israel, Christianity replacing Judaism. And a lot of that is predicated on what we perceive as a kind of ethnocentric, parochial, nationalistic, privileged understanding of being God's people in the Old Testament. And what I'm looking for is a way of inhabiting that more, but with a still a kind of, I guess, cosmopolitan sensibility. I mean, the idea that, yeah, we have a covenant with God and we think it's pretty great, and that gives us special responsibilities to do. And some of those responsibilities do carry us over into the covenants God has with other nations and with the more than human world. And so we do have some kind of go-between obligations there. But what happens in those covenants is not for us to determine or manage or manipulate. Our role is to operate out of ours while recognizing that our God is the God of the whole world. And that means God has covenants with other nations and nature. And so it is, I don't know what to call it, but it's recognizing our specificity, our obligations within this framework, while at the same time not imposing it on others, and recognize the autonomy and integrity of those other covenants. We can't say much about it biblically because so much of the biblical material is devoted to these people.
Right.
But there are these gestures and these hints that there's and they emerge kind of late in the biblical witness, I guess, but it still shows that there are people thinking, mm-hmm. well, maybe God's doing something else with those folks. And we can just trust that God will do that well. In the meantime, we have our calling to do what we're called to do. And that would extend to nature as well as the nations.
Well, and I do think it's really important to remember that the Hebrew Bible is primarily about God's covenant with Israel.
Right.
And that's not a weakness. It's a book specific to this relationship. And so the fact that, like I read somewhere, sort of a complaint that there weren't more kind of cataloging of flora and fauna in the Bible, which I was like, I mean, that would have been fun, but like, they're going to talk about the animals with whom they relate regularly. They're not going to be cataloging all the birds of ancient Israel.
It's a very different pattern of life catalogs things, isn't it?
Yes. And so I think that's important to remember. I also, so sort of personally, I don't come from a religious family, and I think that that really influences who I am as an interpreter. Growing up, I did interact a lot with evangelicals who were sort of apologetically sure that my family was going to hell, but that I would be fine. So not just that I was like going to heaven, but it was all going to be great. And I was like, I'm sorry, but like this just isn't gonna, I don't see a way where this could,
I get all this good stuff and my family gets hell is hardly good news.
Yeah. Like the idea that I could be like just taken out of my family.
Right.
And then I'd be okay, even though everyone else were suffering eternal torment. Like that just is like a bizarre idea to me.
Yeah.
And part of, I think what I've taken from that is that, that I have a very hard time understanding ideas of salvation that aren't deeply communal, and that tends to like spread.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean like, clearly my relationship with God is different from my parents because they don't believe in God, or interact with God, or, you know, they don't engage in regular, worship or rituals or anything like that. So I can say like, yes, we are different. But I don't therefore have to say they are eternally condemned, or like, I can't trust God with them, because that's basically what saying they're going to go to hell means, yeah. Right? It's like, God's going to take care of me, but like, God's going to be real mean to everyone else that I care about. And so I think that it's not that I was looking or thinking about that when I started looking at animus and stuff, but I do think that is part of why it appeals to me as a way to read, because it is much more like relational and communally relational.
Yeah.
It's like a relationship that doesn't depend on a strong sense of the individual as the sort of node of the
right. Deal.
Yeah.
And it also understands community difference as well. I mean, I think our Western reading of the people of Israel is that this is a discrete body of people set over against other bodies of people. Whereas I learned from your book that the animist sensibility is my community is with this group of people that I have some proximity to, human and more than human or other than human. And those outside of that are potential people. But I can't say anything about them because I don't interact with them.
Right.
And so the contrast between our community and other is different than the way we Western think politically, yeah. Think of us set over against them. These are discrete communities made up of similar kinds of people who have different patterns of life and so forth. I just don't know that kind of notion is very prevalent in the, if you're reading through an animist lens, the biblical sense of being a people takes on a fairly different quality to it.
Yeah. The it's more about the people you live with than about some sort of like inherent, like it's not genetic.
Yes.
Like if you think of genetic testing, you know, 23andMe or whatever those things are called, like they assume I've not done it, but I've had people tell me of the result and they'll be like, you know, I'm like 7% Swedish. I'm like, I don't know what that means. Yeah. Like there's some sort of like original Swedish genetic code. Like there are people who have lived in the landmass that we call Sweden at different times.
Yeah.
And sometimes they have moved around more and sometimes they have moved around less, but at all times have there been change.
That's right.
So like Norway, for example, lots of Portuguese sailors coming to get the cod from Norway to take it back to make delicious things with. Like, do we count that as like not Norwegian DNA?
Right.
Like, what if they came really early? Then yeah. Does it count? Like, when do we say we have the like Norwegian DNA thing? And I don't think, like, I think that messes with our brain, basically, that there's this sense that you can arrive at some final definition of what a people yeah. is instead of, and I mean, colonialism and like yeah. blood quantum loss, like make it all worse, right? Like you have to like
yeah.
genetically prove you're indigenous rather than like, are you an active member of a community? Does people in the community know you? Do you know them? And that can happen on all kinds of different, like it can be a question of language. It can be a question of like family relationships, but those may or may not be genetic. Like,
right.
You could be adopted in, like there's all kinds of ways that you can participate in a community and those, and the rules for that are fluid.
Yeah.
Sorry, I get really excited about genetic testing. I think it's so weird.
Well, I've been intrigued by it, but I've read a bit on it, and I now think the whole thing is pretty highly suspicious, because as you've indicated, they have to, for it to work, you have to assume that at some point in time, in some region, there was a stable enough population that you're calling Norwegian or Swedish or Scottish, whatever it is, and then comparing DNA from there to now. And there's just never that kind of purity. And the smallest variance gets amplified very quickly within a few generations. And so I just think the whole thing is highly speculative. It's kind of a fun parlor game to play. But I don't think it gives us very much evidence about what we're actually from.
Yeah. So. Well, and I think reading it, sort of that's like my very mean reading of the whole thing. But I think reading it sympathetically, I think part of what people are looking for is connection to a particular place.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
And that yeah. I do think has like that Israel is a people, not just because they live together, but because they've lived together somewhere.
Yeah.
And that I think is important and like worth searching for. I just don't think it's in our DNA.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, exploring my Scottish ancestry and roots has been one part of a broader personal project of trying to think of myself as something other than white. To think of myself as having a particular ancestry connected to a place with a particular history, with all the messiness that comes with that,
yeah.
Is a more truthful telling of the story than white, which erases all of those.
Yeah.
I went through a Undoing Whiteness or something like that. I can't remember the name of it, but an online course. And they said, you know, white folks, people identified as white, have indigenous cultures as well that have been erased by the colonial category of white. Mm-hmm. And so exploring that history, however ambiguous it might be, is a way of doing that. And I suppose genetic stuff is one tool in the quiver for doing that. But all too often it gets racialized in ways that are not particularly good. So, right. Well, I promised you less than an hour and we're a minute short of that. So,
sorry for taking up the time of the rambling about 23andMe.
No, that's okay. I mean, I just enjoy talking with you, and I appreciate your sense of adventure and willingness to kind of go in places that are not in your expertise, because if you're not willing to do that, then it significantly undermines the usefulness of work like yours for contemporary folks. I mean, we're trying to fit together. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, what does it mean to believe in God and engage the world and be a Christian in light of what I think should be a more Hebraic Old Testament orientation. And your book has been transformative in that regard for me, but I'm now sort of thinking through a number of the implications of that. So I'm grateful you're willing to think along with me.
And maybe there's actually a connection there, that that being part of a people means living with a people. And that part of why I get so like skittish about making definite statements is I think it's more important to try it than to figure out the definite like statement of what this means.
Yeah.
So like try to live as if trees are relatives, even if it's like weird and kind of tree huggy, and just see what happens. And like, I don't know what will happen, but it's more important to make that attempt than to say at the outset where it's going to get you.
That is a challenging word for me. I think it's correct. I affirm it and want to live into it, but I'm an intellectual person, and by disposition and by training, I like words and definitions and all of that. The way I hold that is to say, well, I can still do that, but I need to hold it lightly, that these are speculations. These are tentative gestures. I think the fact that we can think about those things means that we probably need to do so.
Yeah.
We just need to do so in a way that doesn't replace the kind of living into that you're talking about. That's primary. We have to focus on how do we live and hold our reflections, especially our more speculative ones, more tentatively and more modestly. And the church has not done very good with that, I'm afraid.
Well, and I do think it's hard in this regard, in that I think often people, it's hard to sort of make the try of the experiment when you fear that maybe you are being an idolater.
Yeah.
And so I think part of what I would say is like, it is religiously safe to do so. Like, that you can try this and remain in God's love.
Yeah. And that's quite parallel to, I think, where my questions were coming from this evening, which is, I'm not trying to say that I have an alternative to what the tradition has said. I'm just trying to carve out a space to say there is a room that we can enter and think differently or imagine differently that is biblically authorized. We might not get to a competitor to the dominant tradition in terms of a systematic theology or something like that. Maybe we shouldn't want that, but we at least have biblical authorization to inhabit a different way of being in the world that thinks about ourselves, the other than human world, and even the divine in very different ways than we're used to. And some of those might have some echo or resonance with more contemporary ways of thinking that have typically been dismissed by church. And so there's a missional possibility there. That's all I need at the moment to, I've still got that fundamentalist in me that I want scriptural authorization, that at least I'm moving in a legitimate direction. And your work has provided some of that for me. So I'm really grateful for it.
Well, thank you for talking about it.
A big thanks to Mari for making some more time for this rich conversation. And a special thanks to Sarah Baker, who composed and recorded the original music you've heard throughout this episode. And thank you for listening to our conversation. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please share this with your friends, review us in iTunes, and visit our website at jesus-shalom.org, where you can leave questions, comments, and suggestions, and also sign up for our mailing list. If you'd like to connect with the wider work of Anvil Trust, you can visit us at anvil.org.uk and join our newsletter list there. That's all for now. Deep shalom to each of you.